The issue here is not, at least for me, Williams' desire for a utopian figure of unalienated labour, though that is present, but instead the way his seclusion requires that all analysis of social relations occur belatedly, post-festum, after the feast, to use Marx's figure from Capital. First the labourers arrive and are driven from the land, then the sheep arrive. For Williams, then, deeply concerned also by the scandalous ways in which generations of readers misconstrue literary references for historical reality, the story of Postel yields a theory of ideology, a confusion of linguistic with natural reality, a reference with phenomenalism. Read this way, Williams' figure of the escalator seems far less hostile to the likes of a William Empson and his some versions of Postel than Alpers at least suggests. Sometimes a trick, but by turns a myth, a process, a machine, a double plot, an organism, or taproot, Postel is a queer business, permanent, and not dependent on a system of class exploitation, but that possibly is a contributing factor. It works by what sounds a lot like taxidermy, putting the complex into the simple, so as to imply a beautiful relationship between rich and poor, giving the impression of dealing with life completely. In Postel, he writes, you take a limited life and pretend it to be a full and normal one. It's a metaplasmic refolding of surfaces that creates the appearance of depth, of life, or liveliness. Not so much by what it adds, so much as by what it leaves out. No wonder Postel endures, takes refuge in a larval Alice, is how Empson puts it. The activity comes to stand for a predatory or proactive sense of mimesis, not exactly the ambient or ambulatory quality of nature writing that Timothy Morton has recently named an eco-mimesis, but a more fundamental, unromantic stuffing. For Empson, Postel names the operation by which language touches itself, and by that touching, which is in truth a folding, traces a skin on the world, produces a set of effects that may be taken as reference, spun off as so many worlds or costs. What was Postel again? Ideology? Mimesis? What about all those shepherds? No shepherd, no Postel, to which I had sheep. Bah. Sheep are the given. Sheep of the stock, or capital, so the story goes, that shepherds own in order to maintain the fiction that they are not hirelings, but freemen. Sheep are the creatures whose care leaves our poets so much time on their hands. Otium, that is. Otium honestum, we hope. This is one of the points that John Fletcher is keen to make in the preface of his wonderfully successful The Faithful Shepherdess, when he instructs his readers, you are ever to remember that shepherds are owners of flocks and not hirelings. Which is to insist, in a sense, just to avoid confusion, that they are not sheep. There were, of course, and I suppose are, times when it's important to remember that not sheep, in this case, in the Renaissance case, poets and courtiers especially, were really, in fact, not sheep. Except, of course, when it was good for a person to be a sheep, and you found yourself lying down in green pastures, celebrating that, whatever the circumstances, you would not lack the aid of a certain divine shepherd. Or found yourself a bit overexcitedly signing letters addressed to Queen Elizabeth I with the epithet, Your Majesty's sheep, and most bound vassal, as did Lord Chancellor Sir Christopher Hatton in the early 1590s, Elizabeth coming to refer to him affectionately as Robert Cecil, not very charitably, but later opine as her mum. Sometimes it was good for the not sheep to be a sheep, reassuring, maybe. Given the right shepherd, a little sexy. Obviously, I'm playing here with a fairly evolved set of metaphors that, as an animal behaviorist or ethologist would tell you, has had nothing at all to do with sheep. But for an analyst such as Fernand Braudel, or for any associative model of social relations, these metaphors are indexed to an alliance of human, animal, and plant resources or actors, an ancient choice or priority for ruminants and wheat, Braudel writes, which from everything else is descended. To the extent that Postel speaks to the world produced by pastoralism, even from the remote venue of the urban or the picture postcard hibbles, it mobilizes metaphors that derive from what Harold would call the formation of a multi-species, human, dog, sheep, goat. By the mutual domestication of animal and human, transhuman husbandry is etched into the land. It built the circuits that paper Postel will and now travels. The problem with Postel comes with the fact that, whereas the remodeling or the remolding of human and dog yields for Haraway at least a positive model of the companion species. The articulation of sheep as stock offers a model, still a companion species, rooted in domination. The trade-off between sheep and human, not sheep, or only sometimes sheep, is not one of mutually enhanced expertise, but instead body parts for in return for a limited exposure to predators. There are good and bad companion species, good and bad multi-species. Only to arrive did the competitive world of human-ovine-canine relations in a Europe shaped by the wool trade. Edward Topsell devotes over 50 pages of his history of four-footed beasts to his justification of English sheep as the most useful of animals. He makes a particular point of congratulating Englishmen on their good fortune because of the absence of wolves in England. This means that sheep feel no fear. This is why their wool is so soft and curly. As Gaucon Pastor has told us, at least for Thomas Wright in his Passions of the Mind in general, the sheepy experience of predation by wolves served as a privileged example for discussions of the passions in humans. The sheep of England would appear to be an insular exception. They feel no fear. Oh, happy English sheep. Oh, happy English not sheep, and then not sheep, sheep dogs. So what about those more versions? What do they entail? Well, if you are an animal behaviorist or a primatologist turned sheep farmer, as in the case of Thelma Rao or Vincent Despre, you don't assume that sheep are sheep. Instead, you treat them as members of a much broader group, or gregarious, long-lived vertebrates capable of mutual recognition. You give them a chance to be more interesting, less objectal or slimy. For Rao and ethologists in general, in a world where there is only mediation, where mediation is recognized to be the way tomorrow's world is constituted, all that matters is the rubric by which you model things, the way in which you're put into use of the world renders it available for successive uses. The question for me, I won't yet presume for us, is essentially the same. How then to inhabit pastoral and its range of variously sheepy metaphors a bit differently, a bit more interestingly, to use Ryle's favourite word, with an eye to their occluded or latent possibilities. Perhaps somewhere in the pastoral archive, Agamben's figure of a dawdling, idling Photium persists. And this, I think, is the Ansonian gesture. What is or what will proletarian literature be is the question some versions of pastoral attempts to adjudicate. Will it or must it be pastoral? Likewise, it's important to recall that Williams's portrayal of the pastoral escalator runs in tandem with his deployment of the terms residual, dominant, and emergent as categories of description merely, which, having no referential basis in historical reality, nevertheless are used by a critic as a sort of advanced GPS system as he tries to work out when or where this or that cultural phenomenon falls in a story of human making and manufacture so mediated by the means of production that it's hard to know which cultural forms are progressive or regressive. In other words, if there is no exit or end to pastoral, it's because the activity it designates describes a process by which human discourses apprehend something called the world, inclining it so that it comes to bear on and speak with human concerns. No retreat, then, and no return. Pastoral is it. Given what I think pastoral is and was, it seems much too early to be moving on, much too premature to think that we can escape its metaphors. Instead, let's trace its latencies, its badly behaved metaphors, treating the general text as the warp and weft of a knitted skin. As I've argued elsewhere, this is what Thomas More begins in the Utopia when he has Raphael Ephraudaeus summon the sheep of England to carve on Morton's table in order to speak the truth about human labour relations in Tudor England. There's this obnoxious English lawyer who's claiming that some poor people prefer to be rascals, and Raphael shuts him up, claiming Morton's attention by mentioning the strangeness of English sheep who have turned on saddle and now eat their shepherds. Raphael's In England Sheep Eat Men exposes the depredations not of enclosure per se, but of one particularly sinister companion species, the enclosing great landowner who raises sheep for wool. Raphael's animal summoning carves a predatory ovine, sort of a minimal unit of sheepy antagonism,